welcome to Book Talk. Can we give you a lift? I'm Danny Scott, your host for this edition of the show, and today we're talking Under the Skin, Michelle Faber's macabre, murderous, unsettling, and unpredictable novel. First published in the year 2000 and recently re-released as a Canongate canon, Faber's genre-busting tale hones in on Iserly, a lonely alien patrolling the A9 in the Scottish Highlands, in her shabby, hot, red Toyota, looking for lone, well-muscled male hitchhikers. Iserly isn't looking to give these hitchers a lift to her boudoir, or even the local spa. She's a hunter, based on a local farm run by aliens who are working for an interplanetary corporation, trading in delicious human meat. To recreate the feeling of Faber's book, we've overheated our studio and buckled our show's guests into their seats. Nervously looking over the desk at me is Sarah Stewart, a senior editor at Floris Books, director of the Lighthouse Literary Consultancy, and a soon-to-be-published children's author in her own right with Stripes. In the other seat is Faber and Faber published crime writer, ex-nuclear physicist, and co-founder of Scottish Writers FC, Doug Johnson. Welcome to the studio, guys. Much to discuss. Now, I've spent weeks fine-tuning questions for this show and want to kick off with one of my strongest. So, Sarah, did Under the Skin get under your skin?
What a good question. Yes, it definitely got under my skin. I found it totally compelling and really, really difficult to put down, actually. Even though it was repulsive in sections and quite disturbing to read, I think it was just brilliantly paced and unfolded so slowly that you were just dying to find out what was going on.
Yeah, I would go along with that, absolutely, with what Sarah said. I mean, it's kind of masterclass in sort of drip-feeding you, like, terror and tension. I mean, the opening 50 pages are just unbelievably gripping. When you, I mean, all it is essentially is a woman driving up and down a road, but it's like it's much, much more sinister than that.
Yeah, anyone that's read this book seems to shudder. They say, have you read Under the Skin? They go, yeah. One of the people that echoes that is Larry Don, the author, who said she read it years ago and still has the taste in her mouth. Baffling, dark, shocking, and wonderful. So I've not read other Faber novels. I know that you have. How does this measure up against his other work?
I was kind of awestruck by this because one of my favourite books is The Crimson Petal and the White. And I've also read some of his short stories, a collection called The Apple. I think Crimson Petal and the White is just an outstanding novel. And this is an outstanding novel as well. They are so different. And I think an author who can juggle different genres so effectively and do them equally well is quite an author.
Yeah, it's quite annoying that, actually, as an author. Because, you know, I've written half a dozen novels and they're all kind of set in contemporary Scotland. They're all kind of similar themes and similar kind of characters and stuff. But this is like, if you compare this to The Crimson Petal and the White, it's like, is that the same writer? How could the same writer come up with them? And that was, and they came one after the other, I think, as well. Kind of get published them quite soon after each other. It's like, it's like he's kind of experimenting with different kind of stuff. And I think his next novel that he's got coming out is about, I mean, it's returning to kind of sci-fi. It's about missionaries taking the word of God to aliens in space. Immediately when he said that, I was like, that's an awesome idea. I wish I'd thought of that. And that's right up his street, I think. You can see how you could have a lot of fun with that, I think.
I think it's always sad when you pick up a book as well written as this is how quickly you get used to good writing. Like you get used to your new car and new house. It seems so new and wonderful at first, but you get so used to it. Then I was dipping back in looking for quotes. I thought this is, I couldn't choose any quotes. So as an editor, author and poet, what did you make of the writing, Sarah? How would you describe it to someone?
Oh, that's difficult to answer because he makes it look so effortless. I didn't read it with a sense that I was being, you know, stretched intellectually or that I didn't pause and think, what a beautiful bit of prose. But you're right, when you dip back in, there are stunning bits of prose. There's a piece near the end when Iserly's talking about imagining being dead or no longer in this world. She pictures herself as the water in a loch and then rain bridging the space between the sky and the ground. And it's stunning, but I enjoyed the book so much as a gruesome page turner that I didn't really pause to notice how good the writing was. In a sense, I think that just shows how good the writing is. So.
Yeah, it doesn't draw attention to itself. I mean, it's very subtle. And prose, I mean, for a lot of the stuff, like those first 50 pages I was talking about, the prose style is very understated. Mm. There's a nice rhythm to it, but it's nothing more than you need. It's just exactly enough. And it's very clever the way, I mean, it's a great idea to build on because he's seeing it from alien eyes. He's seeing it from an outsider's point of view, which gives everything a kind of freshness that you wouldn't have if it was just me or you or somebody else driving up the A9, you know?
Yeah. I think freshness is such an apt word there because all we know of these people are the animals, the race that Iserly has come from. They're so dark and underground. That's pretty much all we know. And she longs to live in a lighthouse by the sea. There's so much about, you know, water and air and cleanliness and freshness.
Yeah, I mean, you're constantly, and Iserly's constantly, I mean, when it snows, she's kind of like lost for words. But then at the same time, you know, her reaction to sort of the natural world is incredible, and you're seeing it through these fresh eyes. But at the same time, her reaction to the vodzils or people that she's picking up in her car is the exact opposite end of that. I mean, they're like, I mean, it's, that's the main theme of this book, is about dehumanization, I think, where you have this sort of idea of like humans being less than human, and also this idea of just this, the amazing natural world, which she's so unused to. It's kind of really weird. It jars, but it doesn't jar, if you know what I mean, at the same time.
Mm-hmm. What's Faber putting into play in building her character here, Doug, as a writer?
Well, she's a kind of classic outsider, isn't she? She's an outsider on Earth because she comes from another planet. But she's an outsider in that she has been sort of surgically changed from being her own race to seem more human. Mm. So she doesn't have any home anywhere. She's given up whatever her life would have been in that other place, in that planet. And she's come to Earth, but she's never going to be welcome anywhere. Nowhere's home, effectively. It immediately creates a kind of sense of empathy with the reader when you're reading about Isolde. So even though she does some extraordinary things morality doesn't really come into it, like it does, but not in her mind, that keeps the reader on board for all of that stuff that she does, because you kind of want better things for her, despite it all.
I agree that she's a very sympathetic character. She's a victim in so many ways. But there are aspects where she doesn't perform as a victim. There's a scene where she's sort of picking through the food that's left in the canteen after her colleagues have gotten at it. And she says, "Is there any of the high quality meat left?" And you know, she's still quite, there's something about her that is striving to raise herself out of the situation that she's been stuck in. And she's almost a disdainful element in the way she looks, both at the hitchhiker she picks up and the people she works with, which I think makes her really complex and well-rounded and all the more interesting.
Outside of Isolde, who's obviously a huge part of this book, and it's sometimes hard to remember this book's written in the third person.
I didn't even stop to think about the fact that we were getting the hitchhiker's perspective. I don't know what you thought, Doug. I sort of just enjoyed it and it rolled into the part of the story.
When I write my novels, I kind of stay in, like, I use a similar technique, but you stay inside one head, very closely in there, right? I mean, in like that, you know, third person authorial. But it might as well be first person. You could almost switch it to first person without any difference. And I found that the bits when you got into the hitchhiker's point of view, I thought it would have been really interesting if he could have portrayed that stuff through the dialogue between the two of them, just from her point of view in the cars, if you see what I mean. Just to keep it absolutely like tunnel vision focused on Isolde's, you know, train of thought and her mind. Right. I mean, it was fine. I mean, he was obviously using the POVs of the hitchhikers, whether it was locals moaning about whatever or like, you know, German tourists or whatever. They didn't necessarily come across very well, any of them.
The hitchhikers are supposed to provide, I think, a lot of the dark humour of the first half of the novel. There's a brilliant bit where there's a guy talking about, I think he's really into music, and he's talking about John Martin or something, and he thinks, "I wonder if she's got any tapes, plenty of time for a C90 before Pitlochry," which is one of the best lines I've ever read, ever. It's so strange and silly, and I think that humour just helps to unsettle the reader even more. That's what happened for me.
It's worth pointing out that this is kind of darkly humorous for quite a lot of it. It works really well. I mean, not the humour, that, like you say, those hitchhiker scenes are kind of funny, but after the first one, you know exactly what's going to happen. Although what's brilliant about it is that it doesn't always happen, because I mean, every scene she's trying to find out enough about them to know if there's people waiting for them, to know if they're loners or not, to see if it's too risky to take them. So all the way through, every single encounter with a hitchhiker, you're like, "Oh, Jesus, this guy, is she going to take this guy? Is he going to get away?" And when he gets out of the car, even if he's an arsehole, you're kind of like, "Oh, okay, he's out of the car. Thank God, run away." You know, so it's brilliantly done.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because were you on the side of the hitchhikers then?
Well,
I'd remember when the big moment, the big reveal, one of the big reveals in the book, one of the many big reveals in the book, is the hunt for the four escaped Vodzils running around with their little acorn willies. And I thought, come on, you can catch these guys. You can catch these guys. And then I was thinking, that's disgusting. How can you think like that?
So that's the power of like Faber's narrative that he's created here and the empathy that you've got. But literally, you want her to catch those humans. It was like completely mutated humans and effectively kill them or recapture them. You know, and it's like, Jesus, what have you done to me, Michelle, you evil man? It's brilliant.
In the version that Sarah and I read, Cloud Atlas author David Mitchell says that in his preface of the book, Under the Skin is one of the best orchestrated reveals in modern British fiction.
It's just beautifully timed. Like every single little drip down to the word and down to the bit of punctuation even. I mean, the first time that he uses the word Ikpathua or whatever, I don't know how we're saying this, but that's the kind of, and you're like, and he never explains it.
Nope.
Which, I mean, you know, never apologise, never explain, all that stuff. You know, he never explains what it is, and you're like, what? And then when he says Vodzil, and you're like, what? And then like starts talking about her surgery, and you're like, what are we doing now? And it's just, I mean, it just continues on and on. And she, I mean, that's 50 pages of nerve shedding, and then she gets back to the farm. And then you're like, what is going on? Yeah. Here are these lupine creatures? And it's just, it's absolutely astonishing. It's just so well done. It's understated. It's really clever. And it's just at the right moment every time. And just when you're thinking you've got a handle on it, he just drops another tiny little nugget in your lap.
I'd hate to have to write a pithy summary of this book. In your role as an editor, how would you sum up this genre?
I should preface this by saying that I'm not a fan of sci-fi at all. Right. I read across all genres for work and look for good stuff in all genres, but if I was buying something to take home, I wouldn't pick up sci-fi. Mm. And I guess this is sci-fi. Maybe it's the closest shelf you could find to put it on, but it also has a kind of feeling of a psychological thriller or a really macabre ghost story. I know there aren't ghosts, but the idea of like a sole protagonist and the tension just ratcheting up and up made me think of a lot of old-fashioned ghost stories.
Yeah, it's a kind of literary horror. I mean, you maybe call it. I would say it is sci-fi, I guess, in one sense. But I mean, it's set on Earth, and you know, and there's none of, you know, it's not like a space opera or something like that. Mm. And in fact, it's that's the one element that grates with me slightly. I don't think the sci-fi stuff hangs together. I mean, if this race come from another planet, right? That's presumably, if it's not in the solar system, that's interstellar travel. That's incredibly advanced. And, you know, unbelievable levels of technology they have. And they send one person with really bad surgery to go up and down the A9. Why don't they just farm humans on their own planet? Why don't they just take a few and do that? And there's a hint towards that near the end of the book, actually. Mm. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, surely this is a humongous big, you know, multi-planetary corporation doing this. Mm-hmm. And it's worth extraordinary amounts of money, this Vodzo meat. It doesn't add up. I don't understand why they don't just take over Earth or whatever, you know?
I didn't think they were aliens. I know I'm sitting here saying, yeah, sci-fi. But I didn't think of them as aliens. I thought of them as strange mutant underground animal creature things. I have no idea what I'd describe them as.
Well, of course, brilliantly in the book, they're referred to as humans.
Yeah, that's a great subject.
Which is just the first time he says that, you have to sort of go back and go, what? Yeah. And then, of course, humans are Vodzils and these creatures are humans. That's just, of course, brilliant, fantastic. And that's a fantastic misdirection at the start because, I mean, your sort of central idea is you've got a young woman driving up and down, picking up male hitchhikers. Mm-hmm. And the way he writes it is, you know, are they suitable? Are they big and brawny? She basically likes them big and, you know, lots of muscle and stuff. And, like, he's totally misdirecting you for that whole opening sequence.
Yeah.
You're thinking, we're into some kind of sex predator thing going on here. It's fine, you know, and over there. And then it's like, okay, Vodzils.
Vodzils. He knows what he's doing, isn't he? He takes out the tongue and he castrates.
The bit that disturbed me the most in the whole book was the bit when that poor Vodzil puts together some straw and tries to scrape the word mercy in the dirt.
Yeah.
And it's echoed later when Israeli is about to be raped, she believes. And she tries to think of the right word to say. And she says murky because she's seen it written down. She doesn't know how to pronounce it. So for me, in a way, the most disturbing parts of the book were the parts to do with language and communication and the dignity that language and communication can afford somebody.
Kind of a black magic on Faber's part that he makes you empathise with Israeli and all the horrible things she's doing. Mm. But he also makes you empathise somehow with the victims that she's picking up and doing this to. I mean, it's not an argument for vegetarianism, but it certainly would make people think about how they treat animals that they eat and stuff like that. Certainly would bring that into the forefront of your mind without ever mentioning anything about that, you know, which is really clever writing as well.
That's the thing, it's about so many things, isn't it? It's about sex and language, and it could be about intensive farming or the environment. It could just be about the way people treat each other, even human beings.
For me, one of the things it's bringing to light is the absurdity of corporate world. I mean, maybe that's an explanation for the strange sci-fi. Maybe a company would fly out to a different planet just to get exotic meat. Her relationship with her colleagues is almost like that corporate feel that of the farmer, Espus. We really learn nothing about Espus. Mm-hmm. He's just in his house. He's just a colleague that she doesn't care about. And the guys in this heartbreaking way she describes these people falling apart in the factory. These guys just falling to bits under the ground. They're all just working for Vess Incorporated and getting nothing for it, really.
And of course, they have this class thing back in on our own planet. There's the estates and the elite, and you kind of nothing in between. That's about on the seventh or eighth level of this book. You know, it's kind of throwaway stuff. It's just in one way, it's just background information about it. It's her backstory, but it's so much more than that. You know, it's got all sorts of clever stuff in it about the class. And then when Amlas Fest turns up, and he's the sort of son of the boss of the corporation, he's quite clearly sort of the elite. He's got a very glossy coat.
Yeah, he does.
which Faber goes on at length about, which is another weird kind of sexy thing. It's like, as you're seeing it from Isley's point of view, and she really fancies his like luxurious brown coat. So weird.
And also going back to the class thing with the estates, she does notice with the hitchhikers that I think there's a section where she comments that the ones who were on benefits or without work tended to be easier. Were they easier to pick off as humans? She gets a sense that there is some kind of a pecking order or a hierarchy, and she can feel the discomfort with the lower members of society cast out at the edges of it.
It's almost like she's becoming more human throughout her journey in the book. The Guardian, in their original review, had a problem with the ending. They thought it was a bit too inevitable. Where would you stand on that? Did you find it satisfying? Or
I didn't question it when I read it, and I'm thinking, where else could she have gone? You know, could she have ended up serving scones in a cafe somewhere off the A9? I don't see another alternative for her.
I didn't see any other way out. And I don't think there's anything wrong with an ending being inevitable. I think some of the best books are like have that inevitable ending that it gives you the kind of satisfaction because you knew it was coming, but you just want to know how it's going to get there. And it's like, I mean, there's no other. I can't think of another way that book could have ended, to be honest.
It would have been interesting if she'd been murdered by one of the hitchhikers. I suppose there might have been an interesting parallel there, but it's just, it was neat and it was bombastic and it all went up in flames. It seemed to be the right ending.
So Under the Skin has recently been reissued by Canongate in its Canon series. Books are selected as being alternative masterpieces. Jamie Bing, the managing director at Canongate, said, "This is about the creation of a new series that is highly distinctive, wildly eclectic, and different from anything else anyone is doing in this country." So where do you think Michelle Faber's book sits in the Scottish canon? I know that Stuart Kelly selected it in his top 50 Scottish books of the last 50 years list. Where does this sit in Scottish writing?
I don't know. Is it a modern Scottish classic? I feel like it deserves to be lauded. I'd almost want to see... Well, I was going to say... see what happens over the years. Does it withstand the test of time? But we're looking at it, 10 or 12 years after it first came out, and it works perfectly. It's fresh. It's completely compelling.
I'm very wary of any kind of, you know, national canon of literature, as I'm sure most writers are. But having said that, it is a brilliant piece of work. It's, you know, it's not a conventional classic, if you like. You know, it's kind of transgressive, is it? I don't even sure what that means, but it's kind of certainly, certainly feels transgressive. It feels like, I feel like I've been transgressed after I've read it. I think, I mean, it's, for me, I mean, it's, whether it's a Scottish book as well, I mean, Michelle's not Scottish, but it's set in Scotland. So Michelle maybe wrote this because he feels like an outsider because he's born in one country, brought up in another one, and he lives in another one. So I don't know. And it's certainly one of the best books to come out of Scotland in the last 20, 30 years, I would say. Right. It's up there for me with like The Wasp Factory and Trainspotting and stuff like that, I think.
I'd recommend this to anyone. How would you recommend it to a friend?
Tread with care.
Yeah, read it, with care.
Read it through your fingers.
Yeah. Don't read it whilst eating a bacon sandwich, maybe.
So finally, Tina Hind on our website commented that she's unsure how this will work as a film. Director Jonathan Glazer took 10 years to hone his script. The film will come out in March. This podcast will be out in February. But from what I can read in the actual film itself, Scarlett Johansson, who is playing Isserly, who doesn't have a name in the film, drives around real-life Scotland picking up real-life men who do not know they're on film.
Really?
And then the men, at the end of that, were asked, as a payoff, would they like to come back for a scene to stand in front of Scarlett Johansson, who'll be in the nude, before they are dissolved in a pool of water. Sounds great. Are you keen to see the film?
I'd like to know what they're going to do, like, makeup-wise with the beautiful Scarlett Johansson. And by the way, I can't really imagine a straight man who wouldn't get in a car if Scarlett Johansson was offering the other. But I'm really curious to see how they make her look small and wizened and broken enough to play Isserly, because I think one of the interesting things about the book is, I don't know if Michelle Faber would call himself a feminist, but it says a lot of interesting things about conventional sexual appeal. Isserly has strange limbs and lots of scars and glasses and no chin, and yet she has these magnificent breasts, and they are all she needs to get these guys into the car. I think he's making a really interesting comment there. Yeah. So I'll be interested to see how the magnificent breasts are concealed and what they do with the rest of her to make her look convincing.
I don't think they'll try too hard to make her look ugly. I think they'll just make her look beautiful. And just, I mean, I've seen that there's been two or three teaser trailers, and they look absolutely mad. And I can't imagine how they would do all the stuff with the other aliens. You know, and I think, I don't know if that's been discarded or what, with this sort of a lupine or vulpine race. I mean, that would be really difficult to do and have it sort of have a kind of legitimacy, which is much easier in the book. But it certainly, the little bits you've seen, it seems to have captured some of the weird outsider spirit of the book anyway. Who knows? There was people apparently when it was on, it was at the Venice Film Festival, there was people, half the crowd were booing and half of them were standing up applauding. So
it remains to be seen.
Seems to be splitting audiences. We'll see.
Thanks very much for your contributions today. I just want to ask, where can we see your work next?
Oh, I'm going to be reading some poems at Raleigh and Broad in April, and then my first children's book's coming out, but not till next May 2015.
All right. And on Twitter?
Yes, I'll be on Twitter under SFS Song.
Fantastic. And Doug?
My next novel, The Deadbeat, comes out on the 1st of May this year. And I'm on Twitter at Doug_Johnston, because somebody else got the one that's Doug Johnston.
Well, we hope we've got under the skin of Under the Skin in this show. But our discussion of Faber's terrifying novel doesn't need to end here. Add your thoughts on Book Talk in the reading section of ScottishBookTrust.com, in 140 characters on Twitter, tagging at ScottishBKTrust, or on Facebook. All that's left to say is thanks to our guests Sarah Stewart and Doug Johnston, Canongate for providing us with copies of Under the Skin, and our producer Colin Fraser of Culture Laser. And of course, thanks to you, the listener, for tuning in. Goodbye, and happy reading.